So by now you know the routine, right? The quizzes will get sorted in alphabetical order. Okay, so my wife teaches fifth grade. She used to teach second grade. And what, sorry? Oh, is that what it is? I don't want to hold up the wrong fingers. You're not leading me down the wrong way, right? Okay, whatever it is. Is that what it is? Okay. Okay. My wife teaches fifth grade. And last week, and we talk about teaching all the time with each other. And she was talking about a fifth grader. Folks, settle in, please. So she was talking about a fifth grader. She was complaining about the fact that when she gave exams, people did not follow the rules. And I almost told her it's because they're 10 years old. And then I remembered what happens every time I give a quiz. It's, what do I say when it's 30 minutes up? I say, stop working, right? And every time I do this, I did this with my MBAs, they're grown-ups. That extra 2 minutes they think is going to make the difference. It never does. It never does. But you feel the urge to do it. So please, 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 on the next quiz, when I say time is up, just stop. It's not fair, it's right. I don't want to talk about the quiz, but what's going to happen is the quizzes are going to get alphabetically sorted, hopefully while we teach, or while I teach and the class is over. I did give all three of my classes quizzes today. So it's my big quiz day. I had a corporate finance class, 200 people in the morning. I had my MBA class, 150 students, just from 1:30 to 3. Now this. I use a first in, first out policy when it comes to grading. So I will grade the corporate finance class first and then the MBA undergrad. So I'm not picking on you because you're undergraduate. You're just last in line because you took the exam late. And as I finish each one, I will send you an email saying it's done, come pick it up, and it'll be in alphabetical order face down. So don't worry, it's done. My corporate finance class, we talk about the notion of sunk cost. You know what that is, right? Once it's happened, just let it go. It's talking about it is not going to change it. Thinking about it is not going to change it. Not picking up your quiz is not going to change it. But it's done. You did badly? Maybe it's your freebie. You've done badly on the first two quizzes? One of them has to be a freebie, and I'll decide which one will be the lower score. Okay? Just let it go. Second, I got about 400 of your DCFs back over the weekend. Collectively, there are 500 people in the class, which means there are about 100 of you who have not turned in your DCFs. I'm not saying this because I love looking at DCFs. I don't want to look at another DCF for the next whatever. But if you're one of those 100 who hasn't turned in your DCF for feedback, I know I told you by this weekend, do it. But if you really get done by Wednesday or Thursday or Friday and you say, I'd love some feedback, send it to me. If I'm in a good mood, I'll send it back to you. If I'm in a bad mood, I'll bury it. But either way, I would respond to you. But try to work on that as well. I mean, those of you who completed, that's a big part of the project. So if you've done it, 70% of the project is done. There's still pricing to be done, but this was the big part of your project. And I wanted to make sure you got it done before we got to the table. So mission accomplished, at least with 400 of you. So today I want to wrap up the last few parts of intrinsic valuation. Remember in the last session, we valued Deutsche Bank. And the reason we did not use dividend discount model was that it doesn't fit, right? It's a money-losing bank. You worry about regulatory oversight. And what do? We projected out net income, and we estimated the variation of reinvestment for a bank, which is how much do you have to invest in regulatory capital. So if you're an undercapitalized bank, you will need to reinvest more. Your equity will be worth less. Your free cash flow equity will reflect it. In fact, if you're undercapitalized enough, you know what's going to happen, right? Your free cash flow equity will be negative, which means you're going to be having to issue new shares, which will reduce the value of my equity. So essentially, we're bringing in what we do with traditional companies to banks. Now, I know I've kind of bundled together financial service companies into this big amalgam as if they're all similar. So somebody help me out. I'm going to go back to basics. Okay? What makes, with a software company, we can talk about what makes a software company special. High, you know, great software, proprietary software, high margins. If you're looking at a bank, a traditional bank, what sets apart great banks from good banks from average banks from bad banks? What is it that banks do that creates value? What does an old-fashioned bank do? It takes in deposits, it loans them out, right? So how do you create excess returns? First is, if a lot of your deposits are demand deposits, you're paying nothing on the deposits. So it's like free money and you lend it out, you know, you're making money. But let's say you're in a world where that's getting more and more difficult to do. And in the US, that started to get more difficult in 1979. So what happened in 1979? Merrill Lynch introduced the very first money market account. And it changed the dynamics of how people kept cash. Because until the 1970s, if you were an individual, you had a lot of cash and you didn't want to keep it under a mattress, you had to put it in a bank. And you know what banks paid as interest? Zero. They gave you a toaster. You got lots of toasters, I don't know. But basically, they said, oh, you're putting $1 million, we'll give you a nice toaster. Yeah, I'll take the toaster, but it's really not making up for the interest I'm losing on. Money market accounts. What do money market accounts do? Merrill Lynch basically took your money, invested in T-bills. They took a slice. So basically, they were doing this for charity. But instead of making nothing, you were now making 7%. And what drove it? T-bill rates had risen to 13%. People were finally saying, this is crazy. Why am I keeping my money in the bank and making 0%? So it made that easy source of money making difficult. So let's turn to the loan side. What separates good banks from bad banks? Can I just look at the interest rate you charge on your loans and say, banks that that make more interest on their loans are better than banks that earn less interest? Why or why not? So let's say you have two banks. Bank A makes 11% interest rate on its loans. It's loaned it out 11%. The second bank has loaned out the money at 8%. Can I say the 11% bank is better than the 8%? Isha, why not? That could, but there's another thing. Who am I loaning the money to? Exactly, right? So if I pick bad credit companies and lend at 11%, I might be charging too low rate. And if I have safe companies, so when you look at banks, you're looking at not just what are you charging in interest, but how well are you assessing default risk in your companies and making sure you earn a rate of return higher than what you need to. So a good bank tries to get a lot of deposits at low rates and tries to make loans at rates that are higher than what you should really be charging them on a market basis. You say, that is so unfair. Life is unfair. And 40 years ago, if you wanted to borrow money, especially outside the US, what were your choices? A bank or a moneylender? A moneylender would charge you more. A bank or a bank? What's changed the dynamics on that issue? So let's say you are a mid-sized company now. The bank is charging you more than what you should be paying on a market interest rate basis because they want to make money. What are your choices now that you might not have had 30 or 40 years ago? You can issue corporate bonds. In the 1960s and 70s, or prior to the 1980s, only big companies issued corporate bonds. Only investment-grade companies issued corporate bonds. Mike Milken and Drexel Burnham changed the dynamics in the second one. You could be a double B-rate company and issue bonds, and small companies and mid-sized companies. Do you see how banks are getting squeezed? On the one hand, the deposit business is getting more difficult because these money market funds and the Merrill Lynches of the world are taking away the easy money. On the other side, you would like to charge more than the market interest rate, but that business is getting more difficult because companies now have a choice of going the corporate bond. And this has been going on a while. So what did some banks decide to do because the banking business was getting more difficult? They decided to get investment banking and trading and real estate, and hence was born the money center bank. Okay? It's not easy money, but it looks like it's easier money than working. It's getting, basically what I'm saying is that the banking business has become more difficult as a business over the last 50 years because on both sides of the balance sheet, it's getting challenges. And now you have, in the last decade, a new challenge. I mean, every bank has some easy money they make. I talked about how JP Morgan charges me $45 for moving my money from my bank account to my bank account in JP Morgan. So why are you doing that? Because we can. And banks do all these things where they nickel and dime you, but the nickels and dimes add up to lots of dollars. And in many ways, that's what fintech is going after. It's not going after the loan business. It's a terrible business to be in. It's going after the easy money that banks are making. So if you look at how easy it is to move money off the banking system. I mean, when I want to send money to my kids, and it's always me sending money, not them sending me money. I don't know why that works, even though they're grown up. I use Venmo. I mean, why would I go through a bank and pay a $25 wire charge? So essentially the mechanism that fintech is creating is taking the easy money away. So banking as a business is essentially getting squeezed. Doesn't mean it's a bad business, but these crises sometimes obscure. So the good times, the bad times obscure the fact that banking as a business is getting more difficult. So banking is one kind of financial service business. Let's take insurance companies. What makes an insurance company a good insurance company, a great insurance company, or an average one? What are the things you would look at? So how do insurance companies make money? And they, but basically, if you boil it down to basic, they sell us policies against losing our lives, losing our property, and they collect premiums. So what drives whether you're successful is whether you're making the assessments of probabilities correct, right? You're very dependent on those actuarial tables coming right. You know that big data was born in Lloyd's Insurance, which was started in the 1400s and the 1500s. Essentially to insure ships. Those days, you think about big business in England, you'd a ship owner would buy a ship and he'd send it off to get spices in the Far East. And remember, this was when you had to go around the Horn of Africa. So half the ships didn't make it. They were either destroyed in storms or pirates took them, huge amount of risk. And the insurance business was born to kind of protect against it. They charge hefty premiums, but they basically said, we'll insure 100 ships and we're right about estimating what percentage of these ships will not make it back. And then we charge a premium on that. So you look at good insurance companies, it's not how much you're growing your premiums, but are you charging enough of a premium to cover the expected payouts that are going to come from this insurance? And of course, if you're lucky and you have a very good portfolio manager, a great portfolio manager, you get an added bonus, right? That's a Berkshire Hathaway thing. You take the Geico money, and you have a great portfolio manager, you get that additional source of value. Very unusual in an insurance company. How about a payment processing company? So let's take a classic payment processing company. Payment processing companies are, let's go old fashioned, MasterCard, Visa. How does that business model work? How do they make money? First is, every time a transaction happens on their platform, they take a slice of it. So when you use your MasterCard to pay for dinner and you pay $100, I'm assuming you go for expensive dinners, okay? The merchant doesn't receive the $100, he receives $97 or $97.50. The typical, that's called the take rate. Okay? So if you're a credit card company, what drives your value? how many transactions or what the dollar value of transactions is on your platform, and then what take rate do you have on that? Historically, American Express has a much higher take rate than MasterCard or Visa, which is one reason fewer merchants accept American Express, because when you use your American Express to pay for exactly the same item, the merchant ends up with $96 rather than $97.50, and he says, I don't want that. But they're credit card companies, right? So what's their second business? Yeah, they give you a $20 minimum payback. You have a $2,000 credit card thing. So basically, they're loaning you $1,000. That's very nice of them, right? But how much do you pay on your credit card? You don't even want to look. It's like what? They do constrain them. You can't charge moneylender rates or, you know, extortionist rates, but it's like 24%. You carry a credit card loan. You're carrying some of the most expensive debt you can think of. This is easy money? Well, not necessarily, because if you're carrying a large credit card balance, odds are you're also a high credit risk. There's going to be a bunch of bankruptcy. So it's not like they make a ton of money. In fact, collectively, if you look at how much credit card companies make on those the money, it's surprisingly small after you adjust for the bad debts and the other stuff that they have to go through. So when you think about financial service companies, one thing I would suggest you do is step back and say, how does this financial service company make money? And when you want to build a valuation, you've got to build it around those metrics. So I'm going to take an example of a financial service company, very different from Deutsche Bank. It's a company called Paytm. Heard of Paytm? It's a payment processing company. It's an Indian online payment processing company, a young company, a growth company, went public a couple of years ago. And I valued it at the time for its IPO. So Paytm is basically a phone app. And every time you use Paytm as your platform to buy things, they keep a small percentage, a take rate. So it's like the credit card model. So when a fintech company says, we created a business that's never been done before, that's not true. It's been done before by somebody else. It's in a slightly different version. So when I valued Paytm, here's what I did. I started with a basic question, which is, you know, to drive, if you think about what drives the value of all of these payment processing companies, the first is how much goes on the platform. It's called gross merchandising value. It's GMV, but it's just a fancy buzzword for how much do people spend on your platform. So MasterCard is GMV. And remember, the gross merchandise value is not your revenue. It's the 3% or 2% or 1.5% you make. And Paytm had some eye-popping numbers when it went public. The most eye-popping number at Paytm was the fact that 330 million people on their platform. So one thing about Indian and Chinese companies that blows the minds of European and US investors, 330 million people, that's more than the entire population of Europe right there on your platform. This is good, right? So when I valued them, I took the 330 million people on the platform. I looked at the gross merchandise value flowing through. And there was a little problem in Paytm's business model, which is they were letting people transact essentially for almost no fee. Why? Because they wanted more users. I remember at the time I valued Paytm, I downloaded their app onto my phone. I regretted it every second afterwards. I mean, this is an Indian payment processor. Every day I would get 12 more notifications on free things they were going to give me. But I kept it on because I wanted to see how much their model was driven by trying to get new users, trying to get free stuff. And the way this shows up is if you look at their take rate, it's 0.79%. That's minuscule. Remember what I said, it's for MasterCard, it's like 2.5 to 3%. For PayPal, it's around 3.2%. For American Express, it's 4%. It's 0.79%. But you could cut them. And I cut them some slack. Then I said, they're growing. They're trying to get users on the platform. They're giving away stuff for free. And I made my fatal mistake. I assumed that now that they've gone public and they got the cash, they would focus on the next step, which is to do what? You got the users. What should you be doing if you're a sensible business? You should be working on monetizing the users, a fancy word for, hey, now I need to make money off these users. Sounds incredibly mercantile, but that's the whole point of having users on your platform. That was a fatal mistake because it turns out that the people running this business are incapable of building a business. You see, how did they get a company to build a company? They're great at attracting users. And for a decade, they were rewarded for that basis, right? In what way? Venture capitalists paid based on how many users you had. So they were encouraged to build business models. But you got to 330 million users. Mission accomplished, if that is your mission, but it's really not your mission. You know what the take rate for Paytm is right now? 0.75%. They've got more users though. They added another 35 million users. This is a train going nowhere, or actually it's going to the wrong place. We don't want to talk about the destination here. But the stock, I valued Paytm at 2,000 rupees, assuming that over time they would improve their take rate, not to some PayPal level, but to a lower number. And the reason it's going to be lower in India is because the Indian government started its own online, you know, money transferring system called UTI, which is free. Essentially, it means that some of the easy money is gone, so it's going to keep the take rates lower. But 2%, even though it's much lower than the US, what I thought was a reachable take rate. You know what the stock is trading at now? I valued it at 2,190 rupees. It's trading at about 600 rupees per share. Massively undervalued, but not as long as these guys run it. I should do a revaluation of Paytm because I get, I mean, whenever I value a company because it's on my blog, people keep reminding me that I'm wrong. You know, look how wrong you are. Look, it doesn't bother me in the least because I'm wrong so often. No? But I need to revisit this. And you know what I'm going to do differently? I'm going to leave the take rate at 0.79%. So these guys have no idea how to make money, but they can keep building users. And if I leave the take rate at 0.79% and increase the growth rate to 50%, you know what my value is going to be? About 600 rupees. The market seems to have built in this presumption that these are user builders, not business builders. And I could say the same thing about half the tech companies that came out of nowhere last year, over the last decade. Because venture capitalists rewarded companies for doing what? Scale up. I remember when the first Bird bikes showed up, you know, the ones that, you know, you rent for an hour and you drop off wherever you want. And I remember looking at the business and this is the stupidest business I've ever seen. How the heck are you going to make money on this? Because, you know, in San Diego, where I live, I can tell you exactly what happened to 20% of the bikes. Teenagers after high school would come and throw bikes off cliffs into the ocean. Terrible ecological thing to do. But from a business standpoint, there go one fifth of your bikes. There was no, and I remember talking to somebody, VC investing, and I said, why do you do it? And he said, big data. I said, what? Because when you hear the word big data, it means I haven't thought of a good reason yet. So I'll throw big data out there. So what big data? So we know when people get on the bike, we know when people get off, we know where you are. And they say, you think you're special? I showed him my iPhone. There are 27 apps tracking me right now. Check your phone. There are probably at least 20 apps. You know why you let them track you, right? Because if you let them track you, it makes your life easier. If you don't let Google Maps track you, you can't use the GPS. And you said, should I buy a Garmin GPS or should I let Google Maps track? I'll let Google Maps track. Everybody knows where I'm anyway. You're not special. There's no big data here. The bottom line was it was a company built on a terrible business model, but nobody cared. As long as you got more users, more cities, and people paid a higher price for having more users, why would you ever bother? So as you look at some of these companies implode because they can't figure out how to make money, the answer is because they factored scaling it. So if you want to, you know, take the Paytm and upgrade it to reflect a management that will never make money, do so. Yeah. Well, that's because if your margins improve from 0.7, if your take rate goes from 0.75 to 2%, you're going to get a huge marginal return in invested capital because the jump in earnings is coming from margins improving. So any of your value companies where your margins improve over time, when you look at the return on capital, because I computed for you and said, this is what your return on capital is between years, it's coming from your margins improving. Margin improvement is like free money, right? Because you don't have to invest the capital. Once your margins start to level off is when you look at your return on capital. Now does it make sense? So that's what the improvement is coming from, is the doubling of the take rate over the next 5 or 6 years is pushing up the operating income. It's actually making it go from negative to positive without much need for investment, because you've got 330 million users already. You don't need to invest very much. You've done your work of building up the platform. Now try to monetize it. Should be. This is actually the part of business where you start to make money, but it seems to be one that they don't want to deal with. So now let's talk about, and this is my last dark side evaluation, valuing companies with intangible assets. I'll be quite honest, I don't like the word intangible, because in accounting, the word intangible is created so you can have two sets of rules, tangible assets, intangible assets. Step back. In intrinsic valuation, what drives the value of an asset? Cash flows, growth, and risk, right? Does it matter that it's physical assets or no, we don't care. If I have a patent and I give you cash flows in the next 5 years and the risk, you can value the patent. If I gave you a factory and I gave you the same 5 cash flows, you do exactly the same thing. We don't treat assets differently depending on whether we can see them or not see them. But accountants do. And that problem carries over into accounting. The problem in valuing companies with intangible assets or substantially intangible assets, pharmaceutical companies, consulting companies, is the accounting is screwed up. We've talked about this, right? Screwed up in what sense? When I ask you, what are your cash flows from existing assets? And you show me your income statement, your statement of cash flows and your balance sheet with the pharmaceutical company, I'm getting junk, right? Because what did you do? You took the R&D expense and treat it as an operating expense. That earnings is really not the earnings from existing assets. So what did I have to do to get this fixed? I had to capitalize the R&D. It's not that it's difficult to value, but the raw data you're given now requires work. Same thing when I ask you what's the value of growth. If I don't correct for R&D capitalization, I get this incredibly high return on capital, not because you take great projects, but because I haven't brought your biggest assets on the books. Every single question, the problem I run into is the fact that accounting, because of its inconsistencies, has made my life more difficult. So here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to talk a little bit about why we clean up those inconsistencies. I know this is way back in the class. We talked about capitalizing R&D and recruiting and training expenses. I know it's a little late, but I want to give you the rationale for why I spent the time that I did going through that process. When I capitalize R&D, and since you're coming off your second quiz, you should be able to answer this. What effect do I have on free cash flow to the firm last year? What effect that cap? None. All I do is move things around, right? I change my earnings. I change my reinvestment. When I capitalize R&D, the effect is not on the free cash flow of the firm. It's in my perception of the quality of the company's project, the return on capital, the reinvestment rate. So I'm going to take a company, and I'm going to take you through the process of what happens when I capitalize R&D. In fact, those of you who capitalize R&D on my spreadsheet, you can very easily run this experiment too. All you need to do is take the S for the R&D, make it no, see what happens to your value per share so you can see. And I'm going to tell you what that difference tells you about your company. So this is a company that most of you are familiar with. It's a company called Amgen. About 15 years ago, it's a big biotechnology company, really a pharmaceutical company in terms of where it is in the life cycle. So in the second column, you see my valuation where I trusted the accountants. I took their operating income, their invested capital. So I did my entire valuation with the existing accounting statements. The value per share that I got was $42.73. Then I checked off that box for R&D. I entered the R&D numbers for Amgen, and it had consequences. First, my operating income jumped from 5.07 billion to 7.3 billion. Why? Because I've capitalized R&D, it changes my operating income. My invested capital jumped by 8 billion because now I'm bringing in all that capitalized R&D. Something very unusual happened in the case of Amgen. Usually when you capitalize R&D, your return on capital goes down. Here it actually increased because the effect on my operating income was actually higher than the effect on my invested capital. But here's the bottom line. With my numbers now reflecting R&D as a capital expense, the value per share that I got was $74.33. I've almost doubled the value of the company. This sounds like a great way to just push up the value of your company, right? But just to show you that this is not a rule, I actually valued Merck at the same time, another big pharmaceutical company, and did exactly the same thing. There I got a value of $40 per share with the accounting numbers. When I capitalized R&D, the value per share actually dropped from 40 to 30. So what am I learning about Amgen and Merck when I do these valuations? Am I learning anything about the quality of R&D investments in these two companies? Can you make some judgments here? I mean, is R&D good for a company or bad for a company? Depends, right? Depends on what? Depends on, like any other investment. Does it increase your earnings? In the case of Amgen, you know what's happening. When I capitalize R&D, it's turning out to be a net plus for the company, suggesting that when Amgen puts money in R&D, it's not guaranteed, but they're getting higher earnings and higher cash flows that more than compensate for the fact that I'm now treating R&D as a capex. But at least in Amgen, R&D is value creating. What did I find out from Merck? They're spending billions of dollars in R&D and nothing is happening to their earnings. And I'm saying, hey guys, stop doing R&D. Send the whole department away. I know this sounds, you know, extreme, but R&D by itself is neither good nor bad. It can create value, it can destroy value. Capitalizing R&D is going to give you. So try that out. With any of you who've used R&D, capitalized R&D, turn it off, see what happens to your value per share. You're getting a very quick indicator of whether R&D is value creating or value destroying. I gave them 10 years. And remember, this is cumulative R&D. At some point you got to say, this is the definition of insanity is you keep doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different outcome and nothing changes. No. In the case of Merck, if I gave them 2 years, you can complain. 10 years, nothing's happening. Something's wrong with your R&D. And finally, let's talk about commodity companies. You know what the most significant feature that you run into when you value an oil company or a cyclical company is, I mean, let's take a big oil company, a mature oil company, Royal Dutch, ExxonMobil, Aramco. When you usually think of mature companies, what do you think in terms of earnings? Earnings are relatively stable, right? You know what Aramco's earnings did between 2020 and 2021? They were up 40%. Between 2021 and 2022, they were down 15%. You do the same thing with Royal Dutch and ExxonMobil. These are mature companies. Why is that? It's oil prices, right? It's not that Aramco produces more oil or less oil every day. Same thing with cyclical companies. You take a mature cyclical company, you look at a recession, their earnings are going to collapse, not because of bad companies, but because they're cyclical. Every question I ask you will then depend on a macro variable. So when I ask you, what are your cash flows from existing assets? And oil prices are $100 a barrel. You show me your numbers. Everything looks great, making a ton of money. And I ask you, what's the value of growth? Amazing. Everything creates excess returns. You take the same company. A year later, when oil prices are 30, and you ask them exactly the same question, every question you get a different answer. And finally, especially with commodity companies, the question is, can you ever use a perpetuity? You see why that's kind of inconsistent. There's only so much oil, so much gold in the ground. You're going to run out of it eventually. So maybe this is one of those scenarios you might say, look, I'll use a finite period. That's why for Aramco, I used a 50-year life and didn't have a term of that. But here's the first obvious conclusion, which is with these companies, the story you tell has a very strong macro component, right? So when you look at Royal Dutch or ExxonMobil or any oil company, the story has a big macro component. It's lurking in the background. And you're going to feel the urge to play macro forecaster. And my advice to you is please don't. You know what I mean by macro forecast. When you sit down to value an oil company, what do you feel the urge to do? Everything depends on oil prices. I'm going to forecast oil prices. Let me play along. Do you have a strong view on oil prices? You're going to go up. So, so let's say you build in a doubling of the oil prices over the next 5 years. I'm going to save you the trouble of valuing any oil company. What are you going to find? Basically, you're going to find every oil company cheap. And then I'm going to ask you, did you find Royal Dutch to be cheap because you like the company or because you think oil price will double over the next 5 years? If you think it's the latter, you know what I'm going to ask you to do? Stop valuing companies. If you're that good at forecasting oil prices, what should you do instead? What's an easier way to make money? Go buy oil futures. If you're a really great macro forecaster, why are you wasting your time valuing individual companies? Just go do some forecasting. The only problem is a good macro forecaster is an oxymoron. You can be a macro forecaster, but you're definitely not good. If you're good, you don't try macro forecasting. You're saying, but what about all those oil price forecasting services. They exist to make soothsayers look good. They're horrifically bad at forecasting. They do it because it's their job. So if you're really good at forecasting, my hat's off to you, but don't waste your time valuing companies. Because when you bring in your macro views into your valuation of a company, you know the problem you create for me. You create this joint effect. I don't know how much you like the company and how much the macro variables are driving. So if you're really good at macro forecasting, my advice is do your valuation with a macro neutral view. Don't bring in a view. Give me a value of the company. You're telling me, is this company good or bad? Then give me a macro forecast, because then I can decide whether to buy oil futures or an oil ETF. Separate the two, because you mix them up, I don't know where one stops and the other begins. And this is one of the few places, or one of the places where I think using probabilistic tools, and I'm going to talk a little bit about simulations and how they can help you, can I think let you get your hands around that macro variable. So I'm going to give you an example of an oil company valuation and how using a simulation made me feel more comfortable. A company called Royal Dutch. It's been around 150 years. One of the original oil companies that developed oil reserves in the first place, mature oil company. Nobody quite knows whether it's a Dutch company or a UK company. It's like two personalities, but it's an old oil company. So this was about 5 years ago, 7 years ago now, 2016. I did a valuation of Royal Dutch for the Royal Dutch Finance Group in Houston. Now, remember what I said, to value a company, you want to be macro neutral. What does that mean? When I value an oil company, I don't want to make assumptions about where oil prices go. So I'm going to use today's oil prices. I can use oil futures prices, their market prices. But remember, oil futures prices are not predicted prices because arbitrage binds them to the spot price. You know what I mean by that? No, because I can always buy the oil, store it, and deliver it a year from now. So when you look at futures prices in oil, they're always very closely connected to the spot price. So when one goes down, everything else will go down. So you can use futures prices. So I wanted to be macro neutral. And I ran into a bit of a problem right from the beginning. At the time that I valued Royal Dutch in 2016, the oil price had dropped. Had dropped to $40 a barrel. And the reason I made that, it had been $70 in the year before, it had dropped to $40. So you see why this is going to create a problem. When you valued a company, what did you look at? The trailing 12-month numbers, right? If oil prices average $70 over the last 12 months, and I take the trailing 12-month numbers, and the oil price now is $40, I'm almost guaranteed to overvalue the company. Why? Because I've taken numbers that reflect the $70 oil price, and I replaced it. I put it into a valuation with the oil price is $40. Is there a way I could estimate how much revenue Royal Dutch would have if oil price were 40? First, give me direction. If oil price of $40 a barrel, should the revenues be lower than what you see in the trailing 12-month numbers or higher? It should be much lower, right? And here, you get lucky, especially with a mature oil company. I went back and collected revenues at Royal Dutch every year going back. This is the advantage of having a company that's been around forever. I can get revenues every year. So that's a column. See the brown line? That's the average oil price every year. Do the two move together? Oh, it looks like they're in lockstep. In fact, just to confirm that my eyes weren't lying, I computed the R squared. Think about what this tells you. 96% of the variation in Royal Dutch's revenues on a year-to-year basis comes from the oil price. I remember asking the finance group at Royal Dutch, or they asked me and said, do you know who the CEO of Royal Dutch is? And I said, I don't know, and I don't care. What's he going to do anyway? Come look at the oil price terminal a little more carefully? This is an oil, in fact, you could probably run the company with Tesla bots running the company to roughly have the same revenues as with the existing management team, right? In fact, the bots are probably going to be more rational because they look at the price, react directly to it rather than play macro prognosticator. So what does this regression also allow me to do? I ran a regression of revenues against the oil price. If I plug in a $40 oil price into this, you know what I'm going to get? I'm going to get the revenues that Royal Dutch would have had at a $40 price. That's what I used as my base revenues to value Royal Dutch. So I'm going to close with a picture because this is what I meant by simulation. In this valuation, what's the one variable that's keeping me up at night? If anything keeps you up at night, it's not what the exploration is. What's the oil price? So I built a distribution of oil price, which is easy to do. It's a traded. And then I ran a simulation. What do you do in a simulation? You go pick a price out of the distribution. Let's say the first price you pick is 55. You value Royal Dutch with a $55 price. You come up with a value, probably much higher than the $39 I got. And I do this over and over again. I used a program that all of you have access to as NYU students called Crystal Ball. It's an add-on to Excel. And in fact, if any of you want to convert your DCF valuations into simulations, please don't send them back to feedback with the simulation. I will trust you. Now, you can add Crystal Ball. It just adds an extra column. You can make those inputs on revenue growth margins and sales to capital all into distributions. You see what we're doing, right? We're replacing a point estimate with a distribution. What you get as output is basically a distribution of value, not a single value. And there's the table that I almost always also develop. The actual oil price, the actual price of Royal Dutch was $42 per share. Take a look at the distribution. What does it tell me? $42 puts me at roughly the 62nd percentile. So what can I say? There's a 62% chance that Royal Dutch is overvalued, 38% chance it's undervalued. Think of how much richer your decision-making is. Instead of just giving you a value, I gave you a distribution of that. So if you want to try it out, it's free, might as well try it out, because once you graduate, you've got to pay for the program. It's an Oracle product. It's well worth it, I think, if you're in finance or in any area of business where there's uncertainty. The learning curve is almost non-existent. It's very easy to use. The statistics learning curve is a little steeper because, let's face it, most of you have asked you what's your only distribution you remember from statistics. It is the normal distribution. So do some homework on the rest of the distributions. But I will see you on Wednesday. And before that, you should hear about your quizzes. Yes.
Just the question about